Today's Teisho will be on case 3 in the Blue Rock collection. Haikigan Roku. Case 3 is entitled Basso's Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. Engo's Introduction. Each key and every kyo, every word and phrase, is a means for the moment of leading students to realization. But every such manipulation is like performing an operation on a healthy body and will give rise to complication upon complication. The great way manifests itself naturally. It is limited by no fixed rules. But I must tell you that there is an advanced theme that you will have to learn. It presides over heaven and earth. However, if you try to guess at it, you will be confused. This can be right, and that can also be right. It is so delicate. This cannot be right, and that also cannot be right. An unapproachable cliff face. How could you manage without stumbling here or there? Study the following. Main subject. The great master Basso was seriously ill. The chief priest of the temple came to pay his respects. He asked, "How do you feel these days?" The master said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." Secho's verse, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." Compared with them, how pale the three sacred sovereigns, the five ancestral emperors. For 20 years I have had fierce struggles descending into the dragon's cave for you. The hardship defies description. You clear-eyed monks, don't make light of it. So this is day 3 of our spring sesshin, and I want to thank everybody again for making an excellent effort this morning. Everybody is doing a wonderful job, and people were coming into Dokusan last night, and a really wonderful spirit of practice. Really quite impressive. Again this morning when I came to the Zendo, people were already sitting. That is how things get done in the world of Zen. Now, if you're frustrated with your koan, if you can't seem to break through your koan, more sitting is actually a good strategy. And if you have other problems too, sitting more is actually a good strategy. Even if you have pain in your legs, believe it or not, and you're having trouble dealing with your pain, the answer is, as usual, sitting more. So it really is wonderful to see people practice the way you all are practicing. Last night, during the period after dinner, a number of people came in to sit. Now, you know, you need your rest. You need to take it easy on yourself. This is not about beating yourself up. Zen is not about inflicting pain on yourself, and it's not about being tough. It's not about being made of steel and, you know, I can take it. That's not what Zen is about. Zen is about being natural. And we are so far from nature, that we don't really understand what that means. You know, when we think about being natural, maybe we think about like granola for breakfast, you know? Or going up into the mountains, going up into a park, and walking in the trees. And indeed, that is nature. That's quite lovely, but. When I used to live out west, I remember going to the Grand Canyon, and You know, to the Grand Canyon, to get to the Grand Canyon in the summer, you come up to the park, and there's a long line of cars and Winnebagos, air conditioned, of course, right? And it stretches really far. It's like miles. And so you get into the park. It's like New Jersey on the edge of the Grand Canyon, you know. So you get into the park, and it's bumper to bumper, and there's this massive campground, right? And you're assigned a campground, and you have to try to find your numbered campsite, right? And so it's like bumper to bumper, and there's a grocery store, Safeway, near the Grand Canyon, and somehow we don't really, you can go out into nature, you know. You can go out into the natural world, but that doesn't mean we know how to be natural, right? So this practice is all about being natural. And it doesn't mean hurting yourself, and it doesn't mean being tough. This is very important, because in Zen, generally, there is a kind of a cult of toughness, kind of a cult of toughness. I admire many things about the Japanese culture. I have been in love with Japanese culture since as long as I can remember. Its architecture, its visual arts, poetry, and of course Zen. But I do think that in Zen circles there has been a kind of a cult of Zen monks are very tough, you know, very, I just think that's not quite right. My own teacher, Genki Roshi, didn't have that approach at all. He wasn't into being tough, I was on the internet the other day. I was in my office, and I wanted to show somebody some of the ceramics that my teacher, Genki Roshi, has on his website, which is Zen Art by Genki. Right? And you go out to the website, and you can see some of his tea bowls, bowls for tea ceremony. And they're quite beautiful, and every once in a while I go out and take a look to see what's available and just to admire his work, because he's been quite skillful. But I couldn't remember the website exactly, so I just typed in Takabayashi Genki, and a bunch of sites that reference him came up, and I noticed that there was one I wasn't familiar with. It was by some artist. And who he had, as it turned out, had studied with Genki Roshi in Seattle. And he had a little tribute to Genki Roshi, and he said, Genki Roshi is the most natural person I have ever known. And when I read that, it really made my heart very warm, because I think I agree, you know. He really was quite a natural person. And yet, you know, what does that mean, really? Wouldn't it be natural to sleep until 8 o'clock, right? Not get up at 4:30. Wouldn't it be natural to, when you want to move your leg, to move your leg? See, I mean, my leg's hurting, I'll move. You know, that's natural, isn't it? You know, so that seems obvious, but actually, that's not what that's not the natural way. You know. We're so far from natural life that we don't even know what it's like anymore. But I'm going to mention something that kind of makes me uneasy. But people in my family, a lot of people in my family, on my mother's side, first of all, my mother's family are hillbillies, you know what I mean? They're country people. They're from upstate New York, and they're Scots, Irish, and a French Canadian people, and they have lived on a dairy. My mother grew up on a dairy farm, and you know, people, they were very poor, and when they when my mother was a little girl, she had one pair of shoes for the year, and basically that meant no shoes in the summer. The shoes were just for school, right? And so basically she had her school shoes, and otherwise she went barefoot. And my grandfather was a hunter, like a formidable hunter. I'm not a hunter, I don't approve, you know. But my grandfather was like a serious hunter. And he would leave the house in the winter, you know, there's no farming. And so he would have a fair amount of time in the winter, even though he had a dairy farm. He could take off and go for days hunting. And he would he was a fox hunter, actually. And I have pictures of him with his dead foxes. And he used to just track a fox for days and days, you know, looking for the trail. And many people in my family are hunters. My brother, my late brother, was also an avid hunter, like a passionate hunter. And he was a deer hunter. And he used to hunt deer by going out into the woods and tracking deer. And I am not in favor of hunting. I don't like it because it's killing, you know. But I think the psychology of hunting is very complicated. I'm not approving of it at all. But I think the psychology of hunting is very complicated because, first of all, I think that people who hunt feel that they are getting in touch with the big mind by hunting. That's the truth. I think they definitely get that feeling. And they have a different mindset when they hunt, you know. You have to sort of become your prey. You have to, you know, if you want to catch a fox, you can't think like a human, right? You know, you have to become one with the fox. You know, so you have to begin to, you have to know fox. You have to know how foxes live, how foxes, what foxes do, how they think, how they act, right? You have to kind of have like a instinctual feeling for a fox. And same thing with deer. You know, my brother would hunt deer, but you know, I almost think it's like a little sick, really. But my brother actually loved deer, you know, and he hunted them. This was something I could never get past personally. But people are psychologically complicated, and I actually think that that my brother did love deer, even though he killed them. And I think that hunters go through a kind of ritual. You know, they go into the forest and they enter the realm of nature, and they're pursuing their prey. And they get up very early. My brother would get up at like 3 o'clock in the morning to go hunting deer. Most deer are immobile as the sun is just coming up. So my brother would have to be in the woods well before sunup in a freezing cold, and he'd have to sit still, noiselessly. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? and you know, so you know, maybe he was my brother, you know, something in common between the two of us, you know. And he would sit there, and you know, you just sit there and you patiently wait. Right? This is like, this is, you know, humans have been on Earth for 100,000 years, right? And for most of the time, this is what we've been doing, right? You know, you get up and you go out and you sit in the woods and you patiently wait. You're waiting for your prey. And if you're a skillful hunter, you know, this is the kind of place deer would like to stop. See, this is the kind of place a deer would like to eat. You know, this is a good place for deer, see. You have to really know deer. You have to become one with the deer. And then, you know, you're waiting for the deer in the cold, in the dark, and you're just waiting, 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 waiting. And a good hunter, you know, so my brother was like a very good hunter. It was like his religion. My brother had no religion except for hunting. And he didn't ever drink, you know. He wasn't one of these guys who goes out in the woods and gets drunk. It was like a sacred act for him, really. My brother took it really seriously. It was truly his religion. And he felt very connected to nature. And the moment of killing the deer was like a moment of a unity with the deer. Right? And I actually think this is very much like Zen practice. Because if you're working on a koan, you know, you're not trying to solve the koan. As long as you're trying to answer the koan, it's unnatural, right? You have to be like hunter of the koan. And that means you have to really pursue the koan like with single-minded attentiveness. And your goal is like, I think when my brother shot a deer, it was like my brother and the deer became one, right? Well, I think that's what we have to do with the koan. You have to track that koan through the hills and across the streams, and you have to achieve unification with your koan, not answer the koan, become one with the koan. See, and fortunately, when you become one with the koan, you don't have to kill the koan, because the koan will kill you. See, and that's just so beautiful when that happens. Superior unification. That's a wonderful moment when the small self disappears and you enter the big self in the moment of unification with the koan. So this is like being natural. See, this is being natural. You can't say, I've got 24 hours, I'm going to catch the fox. You know, that's crazy. You have to say, I'm on fox time now. See? So my grandfather used to leave the house, and he used to just follow that fox all over northern New York State in the middle of the winter. And he had a little food, and he had his beloved hound, Queenie was her name. And they would go across the country, and he would stay with other farmers in the area. He knew a lot of people, and he'd just say, you know, they'd put him up. And then he'd go out again on the trail, see? And he could be gone for a week, 2 weeks. And this is like a, this is hunter's mind, right? You know, hunting is a different mindset. It's an ancient human mindset. You know, you have to become one with your prey, see? And you have to stop being human, really, right? Nowadays we've lost touch. You know, people go out in the woods with all this equipment. You know, people have sonar to catch fish. You know, it's pathetic. It's just part of the general stupidity of modern life, right? But at other times, you know, you'll still meet fishermen like trout fishermen, you know, who refuse to use anything but a fly, and there's an art to casting over the water, and they refuse to have any special equipment except the simplest kind of equipment. And they love fishing, they love the water, they love, you know, so I'm not in favor of it, and I hope nobody leaves here and goes to a sporting goods store. You know, please, that's not our way. It's not the Buddha's way, actually. Killing things is not right. But there's something to this mindset which is very natural, in spite of its negative aspects, you know. And same thing with farming. You know, my mother's father, same guy who hunted, was a farmer, and he mostly was a dairy farmer, but he also had like fields of crops. And where he was from, upstate New York, it's very difficult place to make a living because the land is not particularly good. And it's very cold. Like, if you watch the weather report, they'll say, you know, if it's a very cold day in New Jersey, they'll say it's 15 degrees. And then if you watch they'll do the report, they'll go up New York State. They'll go, it's 15 degrees in at Newark Airport. And it's 13 in the city. And then they'll say, and in Monticello, New York, it's -5, right? And in Rochester, it's -25. And then they go, and in Plattsburgh, it's -35, right? So that's what it's like. Plattsburgh is where my mother's family grew up. So, you know, a farmer has to try. You know, you have to get up early and milk the cows. You have to know when when to plant your crops. You have to know the cycles. So, you know, some crops go in at this time before the frost, and some crops go in after the frost, right? And you have to know that this plant doesn't go in before the frost. This plant has to go in before the frost. And a good frost will help some things germinate properly. And without them, it won't work, you know. So you really have to know your plants. And you know that this plant goes over here next to the river, and this plant has to be up higher where it's drier, because the roots need to be dry. And this sort of thing. And then you plant your plants, and you just don't know what's going to happen, right? And you make your plan, you have your goal, and then you have to let events unfold. And basically that's the hard part of the farmer's life, is that you do your best, you can put in a whole field, but the rain may not come, right? And so you have to be able to deal with that. That there's like a, it's out of your control. There's like a bigger power in control of everything, see? I think if you're a wise farmer, you learn to live with that. You learn to accept that it's not going to rain this year. So you have to be able to deal with the uncertainty. I think you develop, either you go crazy, right, or you get out of the farming business, or you develop a kind of a bigger mind, a patient mind. You know, farmer has to be patient. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty. You don't know how things are going to turn out. And you just have to do your best and then let things unfold. So this is like a more natural way of living, right? More natural. There's a modern life is like plan. You have a plan and you have a goal. So, you know, you say, I'm going to do this, and then I'll make my first million when I'm 30. This is like modern thinking. Or I'm going to get my PhD, I'm going to go here, you know, or I'll be promoted next year, and then I can do this. You know, this is like modern life. It's based on like rational planning. And there's nothing wrong with rational planning, but the truth is that almost nothing in life works out the way we plan, right? Nothing. You can't say with any accuracy where you will be in 5 years. You can't. And neither can I. You know, anybody who says, I've got a 5-year plan, they're just whistling Dixie, right? Because economic 5-year plans don't work. By the way, 5 years ago, would anybody have predicted where the United States would be right now? You know, nobody ever sees it coming. You know, planning is necessary, but it might just be like psychological. You know, it might just be our way of pretending we have control. And it may not really do us that much good. You know, I mean, I don't want to go too far because I do think you should plan. You know, but but we plan, but then as a matter of fact, things are going to go in a certain direction anyway. And we think we control our lives, but you know, actually, maybe that's just an illusion. You know, maybe we just think we're calling the shots, and something, a bigger life is unfolding in a way we don't understand, you know. So Zen practice is like getting in contact with that bigger life. Getting in contact with that bigger life. And the little mind might hate it, you know. You might hate it. You know, you can have a setback in your life, or you can have a disappointment. And you have a plan, and it all goes down, crashing down in flames, you know. And you can get so mad about this, you know. But there's a way of living where, you know, in the middle of your disappointment, you begin to feel alive. You know, it's very strange. It's like, on the one hand, you might feel like kind of despair or emptiness, you know. But then, if you just stay there long enough, you begin to have this joy. I think people are able to find that joy because they stop living in the little self, and they begin to experience like connection to a bigger life, deeper life. So, you know, koan training is a good example of this, actually, because you come to Sesshin and you think, okay, I've been practicing my Zen meditation faithfully. You know, I've been sitting often, and I expect to pass my koan, right? And you've done everything you can to prepare. And you're sitting on the cushion, and maybe you're struggling with the pain in spite of all the practice you've done. Or maybe you're just coming up against a blank wall. You know, you're not making any progress with this stupid koan. And, you know, this is a crisis, in a way, because you know, our planning is not working out, as so often happens in life, right? What we planned, I'm going to come to Sesshin, I'm going to sit on the cushion, I'm going to have some good sits, and boom, I'm going to answer my koan. I'll go in and, the teacher will say, oh, well done, that's the best answer I've ever heard. You know? That's like a dream, right? Dream come true. And you can go home with your fox pelt, right, on the front of the car, right? I bagged my fox. But basically, you may not answer the koan, you know, and you may begin to feel very unhappy and embittered, or angry, or self-hating, and you may also be lost, like despair, right? But that's the limits of the small mind, of the personal self, right? My plan has been shattered. And then if you just go a little more deeply, you know, if you stay there long enough, you might be able to get in touch with this bigger life. And when that happens, you may feel real joy. Real joy. It's like, I hate it. And then if you just stay there, you begin to feel so alive. And it's a bigger life, right? This is the natural way. It's not based upon, some people get to be really good sitters. They can sit for hours. You know, they can pull their legs up and just tough it out, right? And that's okay, but you know, the best way to sit is when you just sit down on the cushion. Well, let me refine what I just said a little bit. You know, sometimes people will sit through one sit, and then they'll think, you know, I'm going to push myself. I'm going to go to the next sit, and the next sit is a lot of pain for them. Right? They sit through that very painful sit. And at the end, they uncross their legs and, you know, said, well, I'm really pushing myself. See, that really hurt, but I was tough. You know, that's not the ideal way to practice, actually. The ideal thing would be, you know, you're sitting and the bell rings and you feel, you know, I think I just want to go on. I just want to go on. I feel good. I feel energy. I'm going to go on. And you go on you know, I hope I'm making myself clear, but in the first case, you know, you're pushing yourself in an unnatural way. It's like you're doing something that's maybe painful and difficult, and you're kind of slapping yourself around and you're sort of pushing yourself, you know. And that's not the way of Zen. You know, obviously you have to do that sometime. If you just keep moving on the cushion, then nothing is going to happen. So you do have to sit as motionless as you can, you know. But sometimes you just know you're in the groove. You know, you're sitting and you're in the groove and that you feel good, and then the bell rings and you think, you know what, I'm not going to move, I'm just going to go through the next sit. See, and that's that's like a more natural way to practice. That's like being in harmony with the Tao. Right? You just get in, you get into this, you feel like you're in something. It's like being deeply in something. You're in a rhythm, or you're in something bigger than yourself. And it just carries you along. This is not always possible, but when it happens, this is a natural action. Natural action. Uwe. Uwe. Try, but don't try. See? Try, but don't try. So working with your koan is like that. It's a uwe. If you don't try, nothing will happen. But then you have to just let go. And letting go in Zen is the hard part, right? That's the hard part. Because we want success. We want to come away from the session with our fox pelt, right? Sometimes, you know, my brother would go out into the woods and not find any deer. And he would track, you know, he'd look for the deer droppings in the woods, and he knew the area very well. My grandfather must have been the same way. He must have known a lot about foxes, you know. So you go out you might not get your fox, you know, you might not get your deer. And if you come home and you say, well, that was crap, you know, I didn't get it. I went out hunting, I got up at 4:30 or 3:30 in the morning, nothing to show for it, see? That's a small mind thinking. You know, you can go out and not find your fox or not find your deer and come back and feel very connected to life, see, very connected. It's not really about answering the koan. It's about being one with the koan, being one with the moment, you know, and being one with life. So you could go out looking for your fox and not find your fox, and still come home with this wonderful sense of connection. See, that's a. Otherwise, what are you doing? You know, really, hunting a fox is not about hunting a fox, is it? It's really about getting in touch with life. You know. My brother really needed to go hunting because he had no other outlets. You know, he had a lot of frustrations, and they would build up. He was a businessman, and he had his own business, and it was incredibly stressful. I remember once he told me that he was mowing his yard, and his accountant came up, and my brother was surprised to see his accountant. And the guy got out of the car and went up to my brother and said, "Listen, Peter, I've just been going over your books. You lost like $25,000 last month." And my brother said his legs gave out under him. You know, it's like you read that or you hear people say that, but it was just like he almost fell down because his legs got weak and shaky, and he almost passed out. You know. And he didn't go bankrupt. He, business got better, But he had no outlets, so he would go out hunting in the woods and tracking these deer. And even, he wasn't really trying to get the deer. He was trying to get connected to life. And I would say that hunting is the wrong way to do it. You know, people develop a neurotic lifestyle because they find the wrong ways to get in touch with life, but including like drug use, but people have other kinds of compulsive or neurotic behaviors, like workaholism. You know, people work for 80 hours a week and they begin to feel connected to something bigger than themselves, and they feel like the universe is unfolding, through their bodies and so on. So I think it's a natural human impulse, but people can get very screwed up actually. By not pursuing this in the right way. So my feeling is that this is the right way, or one of the right ways, that at the end of this whole process you will probably be happier, kinder, calmer, and more full of love for everything. And so that's probably an indication that this is the right path to walk. So this is day 3 of the sesshin, and you're all working on your koans. Everybody's chasing your prey, right? And remember that you really have to learn from the koan. You're not trying to answer the koan. You're trying to unify yourself with the koan. It's just like, you know, when people start doing Zen, I always ask them to work with the breath. You know, please watch your breath. And people think, watch my breath, you know. Give me a real koan, please, you know. That's, at least some people have that reaction. And it's like, I know all about the breath, you know, give me a serious koan. But, you know, when they begin to watch the breath, you know, they realize that the breath is actually quite not at all what they thought. You know, it's here sometimes and it's gone sometimes. And it comes out my head sometimes, and it comes out, I hope somebody won't mind my saying this, but somebody came in last night and said, I'm breathing through my right ear. Right? Now that's really deep concentration. See, I'm breathing through my right ear. That's like extraordinarily deep concentration. Now rationally, we might think you can't breathe through your right ear, but experientially, you're experiencing the moment in a very deep state of samadhi. And in that state, you're breathing through your right ear, okay? So the breath turns out to be something very different from what we think, right? You just have to become one with the breath and let it take you places, let it take you where it's going to take you. You know, learn from the breath, be the servant of your breath. So when the breath leaves your body, where does it take your mind? Yeah? When the breath leaves the body, where does it take your mind? And go with the become. See, it's not really about watching the breath. I say watch the breath. It's really becoming one with the breath. And when you unify yourself with the breath, you experience many things differently. Now, same thing with the koan, right? You know, it's not about answering the koan or going home with a pelt on the car. It's about getting in contact with the life, you know. And so really, answering the koans is really immaterial in a certain way. What really matters is you're becoming one with the koan, becoming one with the moment that you're in, you know. And if you just, you're working with a koan and you're in mushin, you're in a blank mind, and you just keep coming back to that blankness, the koan is going to sink into your big mind, and the big mind's going to do all the work. All you have to do is just keep blanking your mind, going blank, going blank, going blank, and saying the koan. And at some point, you know, you're going to be totally one with that koan. And you're going to notice something or be able to do something that will be more or less automatic. And you'll just know what to do. And you'll know what to do. Now, you know, we don't always trust the big mind because we're modern people and we are out of touch with natural life. We have the illusion of control and planning. And you know, who knows where our civilization is going to be in 20 years, right? We'll see what happens to planning. But maybe it's not so important to be in control. It's more important to be connected to the moment, connected to the world. So you just keep returning to that blankness and make yourself available to big mind. And then pay it, you know, that's all you have to do. Just keep emptying out and saying the koan, and something is going to present itself. And don't try to answer the koan, try to be one with the koan, totally identify with the koan. Okay? The great master Basso was seriously ill. The chief priest of the temple came to pay his respects. He said, "How do you feel these days?" The master said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." Yeah? That's a beautiful, beautiful statement, right? Of connectedness. You know, whatever arises is Buddha. Whatever arises is my true self if I'm in my big mind. If I'm not, then I think, you know, if he were not in his big mind, I'd say, "How are you doing today?" He'd say, "I'm dying. What do you think?" You know? But I myself have known people who were dying who had this spirit. You know, just amazing. You know, I knew this monk who was dying of cancer, and he was just, this was his life, and this was his spirit. You know, everything is Buddha. Everything is Buddha. How do you know you're not in big mind? Because you're sitting there thinking, "I hate this, I hate this." Yeah. So that's okay. It's okay. You can hate it. Just go back to your breath, go back to your blank mind, say moo, till your mind is blank. Sooner or later, it's going to be sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. It's all going to be Buddha. And really answering the koans beside the point. This is what we're here to do. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Compared with them, how pale the three sacred sovereigns, the five ancestral emperors. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Compared to them, how pale is Bill Gates and the presidents, and the 49 presidents, hallelujah. For 20 years I have had fierce struggles descending into the dragon's cave for you. The hardship defies description. You clear-eyed monks don't make light of it. In other words, you know, there really isn't any hardship if you're in big mind. There's really no such thing as hardship. So if you're feeling like things are a little overwhelming, just keep entering Mushin, and your pain and your suffering will disappear. They really will. And if they haven't yet, it's just because maybe fear is holding you back, or lack of trust. It's okay. Just keep going. Sooner or later, that door is going to open up, and it's going to be wonderful. Yeah, I promise.